Hello. I'm Nicholas Lovell. I can't better that introduction. I'm going to try not using the microphone because I want to have my hands free. So if at the back at any point you can't hear me, just put your hand up and wave. And because I'm a native English speaker and you're not, if I speak too fast, put both hands up. You don't have to say anything, just put both hands up and then I'll know I have to slow down. So I've got 2.5 hours, less 10 minutes of student timing, to talk about this, how to make money from free-to-play games. I'm often hired as a monetization guy, which is fine, although nearly all of my work is about retention. It's about keeping customers. Keeping customers is the single most important thing to do in a free-to-play game. It's also very hard. But when you've been making games for 20 years and you're now looking at free-to-play, it's fine to admit that you don't understand acquisition. That's a marketing problem, and I'm not a marketer, I make games. And it's fine to accept you don't understand monetization. That's a sales problem, and I'm not a salesperson, I make games. But if you admit you've got a retention problem, that means you suck at making games and nobody will admit that. And yet that's the biggest problem facing people trying to figure out how to make money from free-to-play games, is keeping their customers. I'm not going to talk a lot about acquisition today. I will talk about monetization, but most of what I talk about will be retention. So a tiny bit about, which is odd because it's all about making money, and has anybody played the new Dungeon Keeper game? Put your hand up if you've played it. Has anybody heard about or read the reviews of the new Dungeon Keeper game? It's basically getting 0 out of 10 reviews across the whole web. There's two reasons why. One is that it's a classic game loved by a lot of people, which has had the free-to-play treatment. And so a lot of people go, I hate free-to-play, you're destroying my industry. You're forcing me to play games I hate for free. I don't quite understand that one, but some of that is happening. And then there is a second problem, which is that it isn't a very good implementation of a free-to-play game. It's not very fun, it's very punishing, it breaks a whole bunch of rules. I think some of the things they did worked really well in The Simpsons, which was not a core gamer title. They worked well in Tapped Out. But when you apply it to a known franchise like Dungeon Keeper, they lost an enormous amount of the fun. And I think there are two different criticisms. I have no time for the criticism of free-to-play is evil. I do have time for this is a bad implementation of free-to-play, which sucks the fun out of this game and replaces it with asking for your money, which isn't going to work in the long term, and frankly for EA, I don't think is even going to work in the short term on that title. So, let's get some of that stuff out of the way. But first of all, a little bit about me. I used to be an investment banker. That was a long time ago. I stopped doing that in 2003, so the global financial crisis wasn't my fault. I've run a couple of startups, and for the last 5 years, I've been originally writing about the industry of games, and it became very clear to me pretty quickly that the future of the games industry was going to be very influenced by the fact that when it is possible to share something freely across the web, when it is commercially sensible to give something away for free because the cost is so low that you can widen your audience by giving it away for free, the price of games was going to fall relatively rapidly. And it's not driven by piracy. That's not the issue. The threat is competition. The threat is other people in your and around your industry figuring out how to give something away for free and making lots of money from it. That's the threat to the music industry, that's the threat to the book industry, that's the threat to the games industry. And so I started writing about free-to-play, this business model which wasn't new in 2008. It was already very successful in China, in Korea, in the Far East. It was emerging relatively rapidly in the browser-based market, but which I started saying, look, this is going to be big and important. And luckily for me, I started saying that before it was fashionable to talk about free-to-play. So I've been saying this for longer than most, which I suspect is why I'm standing here now. Timing is everything. So now what I do is I write a blog, which Ilka described, which aims to be a source of information on free-to-play games, the business. I've just realised my colleagues at Games Brief would say it's not your blog anymore. It's a website about free-to-play games. It stopped being a blog a little while back. And it aims to be a resource. I work with a number of clients. I do three quite different pieces of work. I work with really early stage startups, helping them try and figure out how to find their niche. I work with late stage companies. Some of the examples up here are the largest magazine publisher in the UK, a TV broadcaster, and Square Enix, you probably know if you know anything about the game, if you focus on the game sector. And there it's about how do we adapt? We know how to work in the old world, but the world is changing, and change is tricky for large organisations. And then down at the bottom, I do game design work. I was a design consultant on Angry Birds Go, which was the first fully free-to-play from the inception Angry Birds title. And I also work with a number of games which haven't been announced yet, which I can't talk about. And that's specifically about game design. And all of that informs my work. It also informs my books. This book called How to Publish a Game tells you how to publish a game. It's expensive. It's about £100. This book, The Design Rules for Free-to-Play Games, is a Kindle book, some short, sharp principles for how to make successful free-to-play games. That's very cheap. It's about €3 on Amazon. You'll understand that why about the pricing by the end of the lecture. And this book, The Curve, is my book that came out with Penguin last year. It's about variable pricing. It's not about games. It's about how, in a world where anything digital is trending towards free, how can we still afford to pay the creators and artists and businesses that support those industries? And The Curve is my answer, and I won't go into any details because that's what the second half of the lecture today is about, so you'll have some insight into that. And our next book, which should come out in February, but I work in the games industry and everybody who does will be familiar with the term, it's slipping a bit. We hope it will come out in February. It's 54 a page of techniques, 54 pages. Each one is one idea in an image and the description of the idea to help you make better free-to-play games. So that's coming out later this month. So if you don't already follow Games Brief, do. It's free, and there's lots of really high-quality content on there. So normally, I get to go round the room and ask people to tell me who they are, but there's quite a lot of you, so that will take quite a long time. So maybe we'll just do it by getting you to put your hands up. Put your hands up if you are currently a student. Put your hands up if you're currently not a student. Hopefully everybody... Had anybody not put their hand up yet? Good, okay. Put your hand up if you've played a free-to-play game. Put your hand up if you like free-to-play games. Okay, there are a handful of people not admitting to that one. Would you call yourself a core gamer? Would you call yourself a core gamer? Put your hand up if you would. Would you call yourself a gamer in any way? So there's a bunch of people who aren't gamers but have played free-to-play games. Does that mean you only... Put your hands up if you've only played a free-to-play game for research or work purposes. That's the only reason you've played it. Only one person, two people, not for fun. Okay. I think that's given me a sense. Actually, I'll give one more thing. I want to know a little bit about your disciplines, your focus. So if you're predominantly a programmer, if that's basically how you think of yourself in terms of making games, put your hand up if you're predominantly a coder. Not very many in this room. An artist? We've got two artists.
Half an artist.
Okay. A designer? Coders and designers, people putting up their hands for both, that's fine. A producer or somebody in the process of production. So we have some of those as well. If you're in the industry at the moment, put your hand up. So, okay. How about if you're in marketing or in anything related to that? So we've got some marketing people. They've got quite a lot of marketing people in here. What have I missed? Audio? Anybody doing audio? No, so who hasn't put their hand up yet? Who hasn't put your hand up? So what do you do that I've missed?
Well, I don't work at the games industry.
You're not in the games industry at all. And did you put your hand up?
Yeah, same here.
So you're interested in the games industry. Okay, fine. So that's given me a help. There's fewer coders than I was expecting. More marketing people. Almost no artists. That's fine. I can be rude a little bit about artists later, which I will be, I'm sorry about that. But now, let's get started. And I want to start by talking a little bit about what a free-to-play game means to you. So for those of you, what I'd like you to do is write down on electronically, physically on a piece of paper, I don't mind, five words that if somebody says a free-to-play game come into your head. Any five words. It's not a really difficult test, just any five words. There's no right or wrong. I'm going to take some away from you now, I'm sorry. I'm going to put the word evil up on the board. You can't have that one because I've taken it. Manipulative. I get this one less than I used to, but not a game. I used to get that quite a lot. I started doing these in 2009. Okay, so if you've got some, what we're going to do is we're going to do something a bit like a game of Boggle. I don't know if Boggle is popular in Finland. It's a game where you shake a board, lots of letters on it, and you try and make as many words as possible out of the dice, which have rolled into a shape of into a number of different letters. And every time somebody else says a word that you've got, you put a line through it. And at some point as we go around, you're going to get boggled out of the game. It's not a competition, it's just a way of getting everybody to participate. So what I want to do is fill this board with words that we as a group associate with free-to-play games. So let's start over there. Give me a word.
Never ending.
Okay. Another word? Sorry, we're going to go along. So next one.
Fair.
I like it. Are you in PR?
Waiting.
Next one.
Money.
What do you mean by money? From the business or from the consumer?
Oh.
Okay. Okay, next one.
Lots of users.
Whoops.
Free.
It's a good word. Ilka?
Building.
Do you mean that as a gameplay style?
No, as in you need to build stuff.
Okay. Let's go back there.
It's optimized.
Okay, as in we track it, we use analytics, all of that stuff. Okay?
Paywall.
I'm afraid that isn't a colour scheme. It just makes the board more interesting.
Casual.
Casual?
In-game currency.
In-game currency. Okay. Yes, I'm going back to you, I think.
Collecting.
Okay, let's go along the rest of that line.
Gems.
So say that again?
Gems.
I thought I heard gems. Let's see if there's a better green pen.
Power-ups.
That's a worse green pen. Next one. You're definitely a bunch of designers. You're thinking about the style of the game. Excellent.
Repetitive.
Is that good or bad?
Depends.
Okay. Repetitive. I'm going to come back to there.
Future.
Okay, next one.
Free to start.
You've been listening to Iwata-san. That's how the Nintendo chief executive describes free-to-play games at the moment.
Core loop.
You've been reading my stuff and other people's stuff.
Pastime.
And what do you mean by that?
Just games I play when I want to, just waiting for something.
Okay.
Not the core games I play, usually.
Okay. So, you didn't quite mean it as negatively of this, but time wasting. And passing the time. The reason I ask that is because there's a word often used to be very similar to that of hobby and pastime in English, and a hobby is something you're quite committed to. I think for you, you think of a core gaming as your hobby, and that's different from pastime, which is why I clarified it. I love the idea that free-to-play is more eye candy than AAA, but... sorry, you're not on the same row, are you? Sorry.
Content.
Lots of it, not very much. What did you mean?
At least some.
Some. Okay.
Internet.
You are quite right that it's hard to imagine without the web.
Social.
Hooray, a positive word. One positive word I'm really looking for that hasn't come up yet. Say it again. A time killer.
Fine.
Thank you. Did I give you a clue that I wanted that word to come up? Yes, evil fun.
Time is money.
Sorry, time is money? Yes.
Relaxing.
Where am I? I'm along there. Chap's looking down. He's not looking up at me at the moment.
Escape.
Escape. Say that again.
Iterate.
Yeah. There we are. A monetization catch, did you say? You had the word catch. Because there's nothing wrong with monetization. I see your point about catch, but okay.
Multiplayer.
Where's social? It's up there. I don't think multiplayer and social are quite the same thing, so I put them near to each other. Where's evil? Let's put it near evil.
Simple.
Simple.
Win or lose.
What? Something about rules, sorry?
Win or lose.
Win or lose. Okay.
Commercials.
Commercials as in adverts, you know, viewing ads. Okay. Addictive. Is that good or bad? Sorry? I'm going to put good and bad. Okay?
Facebook requests.
Facebook requests. Another bloody request to rescue a puppy. Yes. Let's go back. Are you a core gamer? I can't remember if you stuck your hand up for a core gamer. Are you a core gamer?
Yeah.
Business. There we go.
First system.
Say that again.
First system.
The first game system, did you say?
Session.
Session, sorry. I did one of these after a flight, where I completely lost my hearing in one ear and half in the other ear. It was really, really difficult to do.
Easy to start.
Okay, where am I?
Feedback.
Constant feedback.
Instant.
Okay, next one.
Grinding.
Is that good or bad?
Depends.
Depends. It absolutely depends on how it's done.
In-game
trade. In-game
trade.
Let's put that up here. In-game currency. In-game trade. Okay, next one.
Trap.
Where's scam? We've got scam on the board somewhere. There it is. Trap. Okay, let's go back.
Mobile.
So I should have put that somewhere near relaxing, shouldn't I?
Yeah. Business model.
Business model. Where have I got to? That's you at the back there. I'll take yours then.
Obscuring.
Obscuring, as in not being clear what's happening.
Sort of
okay. Obscuring money. Interestingly, normally I'd go around again, but I think we might be going on forever. We've had a real focus, understandably, in the first pass on this bit. But this bit's really, really important. And we've had fun. We've got things like farming and building, which are types of play. But nearly everything else is either criticism, things like repetitive and evil and scam and trap, or business model stuff. Time is money, business model, iteration, that's development process. We've got some other positive things, relaxing, pastime, and so on. Why do we play games at all? Anybody got one on anything they've written down which is about games rather than about free to play? You can just shout out now. So let's get some nice words about games on the board.
Challenge,
thank you. I was going to say, does nobody play games for fun here? Anybody else?
Achievements.
Another word?
Exploration.
Why does anybody? Does anybody in the room play Candy Crush? Anybody? Why? Okay. Any more? Come on, you've got to admit to playing Candy Crush for fun, surely. No, my goodness. Okay. Anybody in the room played Team Fortress, League of Legends, World of Tanks, or Dota for fun? Why? Why did you? I'm going to pick on people. Why did you play Dota or Team Fortress or? Just curiosity. Did you just play it for a bit and then stop? Or did you keep going back to it?
Just for a bit.
Just for a bit. Somebody who plays it more. You guys need to play more games, seriously.
Team player.
Team. Teams. Friends. Does anybody in the room like winning?
Competition.
Put your hands up if you like winning. Right, okay. Helping people? No.
Annoying people.
No, I just want to win. Okay. Griefing. Griefing's harder to do in free to play. One of my favourite examples of an unexpected use of a piece of virtual goods is armour in Halo. And I can't remember which game it is that has IAP, but it's a female gamer who, whenever somebody is sexist to her in multiplayer gaming, she basically goes, changes into her pink armour, and then comes back and kicks his ass, and basically goes, "You just got taken down by a girl dressed in pink." And she bought pink armour because presumably somebody in Microsoft went, "Hey, girls like pink, pink will sell." But she's buying it because of revenge and because of status, and because when she takes a guy down, she wants the guy to know it was a girl who took him down. She's not doing it because she wants to wear pink. She wants to make him feel small for his misogyny. And I'd never have thought of that as a reason for why somebody would spend $40 on pink armour. But that's what happened. And that's one of the things to bear in mind as you think about this, that there is an enormous amount of emotion that drives value in free-to-play games. And you don't always understand it. I would never have thought of that one. But it's incredibly important to think about how players might feel when they're purchasing something. But I'm now foreshadowing my second half talk, so I'm going to stop. I think there are a few other words which I'm going to throw up. Things like skill, although an executive at CrowdStar once, which was a Facebook publisher, once said, "Why would you put skill in a game? I just don't understand why you'd do that." Which is back to business model and relaxation and so on. And I think that friends and social element and that sense of achievement are incredibly important. For me, there's a handful of really, really big and important words up there. That's one. That one's another one. I think I might just hold on to those two now. Free-to-play games have to be games first and foremost. It is entirely possible to build a Skinnerbox game. Is anybody in the room familiar with the term Skinnerbox? Put your hand up if you are. Two people. So, okay. The psychologist B.F. Skinner in I think the 30s, experimented on operant conditioning, basically using a reward scheme to train rats and pigeons to behave in the way he wanted them to do. And he did a series of experiments. You put a rat in a cage and there's a lever, and if it presses the lever, it gets some food. And the rat eventually pushes the lever out of boredom, gets some food, and goes, aha, if I press this lever, I get some food. And he'll press it whenever he's hungry. And once he's worked that out, Skinner changed the rules behind the lever. So you have to press it 10 times to get some food, and then the rat will press it a lot. Or you have to press it once a minute, but provided you pressed it once, it doesn't matter how many times you press it, and the rat will just press it once and then sit back and wait, and it will come out. And if you press it, he then changed, put randomness in. It has to be a random number of times in a minute, or a random number of times within a random number of minutes. And the thing which was the most compelling, the thing which made rats and particularly pigeons literally beat themselves unconscious tapping this lever, was when you had to press the lever a random number of times, you had to do it within a random time frame, and the number of pellets that came out was randomised as well. The reward was randomised. And that's basically a slot machine. That's basically what a slot machine does. And a lot of the criticisms of free-to-play games are that they're just Skinner boxes. They're just operant conditioning chambers. The good news, for humanity's sake, is that we're not rats and pigeons. When we figure out that something is just an operant conditioning chamber, it stops working on us. We go, oh, so it's just making me do this because of conditioning. I'm done. And that's a big problem that happened to Zynga, because a lot of what it did, not all of it, but a lot of what it did was heavily dependent on operant conditioning. And there's two ways you can address that. One is you can start injecting fun and creativity and all sorts of other game-like things into your game. And the other is that you can increase the value of the reward, which is why Zynga was hurtling towards gambling rather than gaming until Don Matrick came in and took them back onto the gaming path. So the thing is that when free-to-play started, and people first realised that they could track, there was a word we didn't put up here, which was somebody had optimised, but I wanted to add analytics. This is a bad pen. And metrics. Is that people really optimised for... people really focused on using metrics to drive stuff that weren't necessarily entertaining in the traditional core gamer sense. Although, to be fair, millions of people genuinely loved these games. I really, really enjoyed playing both Farmville and Cityville for a long time. Where was I going with that? So the end point of all of that is to say that we can have all of these criticisms of free-to-play of just being Skinner boxes. If free-to-play was just Skinner boxes, and some games were, and if it stayed there, it will fade away. There'll be a very small bunch of people who will still respond to the operant conditioning, but most people will go, I've seen it, it's done, I'm not interested in doing that again. And the good news is that that will spur innovation. The good news for those people who are core gamers is that it means that free-to-play games cannot rely on just those behavioural tricks. They have to provide meaningful, entertaining content and experiences. How we define those varies from customer to customer. If we were doing a full day, I'd talk quite a lot more about the different Bartle types of players, which hopefully you know about, but if you don't, go and read the Wikipedia entry on Bartle types, because it's really good. And we'd also spend more time on the psychology of why people do things. But instead, you're just going to have to take my word for it that this stuff works, because we've only got 2 hours to do this in. And what I want to start talking about is a structured way of thinking about how to make these type of games. And this is something I've come up with called the Pyramid of Free-to-Play Game Design. And this talk is, in fact, a poster. I'm supposed to have a book about it, but I haven't written it yet. So we designed a poster to explain how the funnel and the pyramid work together. If you spend any time researching free-to-play games, or if you work in any business which is connected with the web, the funnel will be very familiar to you. You have to acquire customers, you have to keep them, you have to make money from them. It's a business model process, and there's lots written about how to optimise the funnel. The pyramid is the game design partner to the funnel. It's about how do I make games that help work with the funnel, but it's more focused on fun and retention and engagement than monetization, although clearly I do think about monetization even in the game design bit. The pyramid is... Oh, here we are. I'm running ahead of myself. There's the bit I talked about, the funnel. The pyramid is you have a core loop. That's the heart of your game. You have a retention game, which keeps people playing for days and weeks and months and years. And you have a superfan game, which sits on top and is where the superfans live, the whales, and where you'll make bucket loads of money. But the superfan game doesn't need to exist when you launch your game. It doesn't have to be part of the minimum viable product. It's possible that some games will never have a superfan game, and that's okay. So for the next 45 minutes, I want to talk through the pyramid. And at the end of that segment, I want to think about some free-to-play games that you either know, although that might be trickier than I had expected, or love, that might be even trickier than I expected, and try to look for some of their retention techniques. So this is the classic way that people think you make a free-to-play game. Your job is to maximise the funnel. You want to get lots of people in. You use metrics to figure out what they like. You focus ruthlessly on converting them. You focus even more ruthlessly on hunting the whales. And you eliminate the freeloaders, the people who aren't going to spend money with you. And I think that's completely wrong. I've now got 2 hours to convince you. So one of the rules we put in the design rules for free-to-play games is be free to play forever. There are many reasons for that. Some of them are karmic, just I like giving people stuff. But more than that, it's becoming incredibly expensive to acquire a customer. Does anybody any ideas how much it costs to buy a customer for your mobile game at the moment?
$2?
That's basically the number I was going to say. Christmas last year, some people were reporting it was spiking as high as $8. Don't launch a game in December. December is the time when EA and Supercell and King are fighting to be at the top of the charts on Christmas Day when millions of people open their new devices and fill them with games. So they are spending an enormous amount of money trying to make sure they are at the number one slot or the top 10 slots and CPI's crazy spike. If you're just doing a soft launch, that's kind of fine. If you have any intention of spending money on marketing, I think you would be on install marketing. I think you would be crazy to spend that in December. But that's okay. We're February now. If you're making a game now, it should be out before then. So I think that you should get your customers into play for free. And at the other end, this is my view as to what your superfans are. Superfans are people who love your game. And what you need to do is let them spend lots of money, and I do mean lots, on things they really value. I'm trying to work out if I can test you to see how much money you've spent on a free-to-play game and whether or not you'll play along. Okay, put your hand up if you've ever spent any money in a free-to-play game, ever. Keep your hands up, put it down when I get to a number that you don't want to admit to. So, $1. If you spent $5 on a free-to-play game, $10 on a free-to-play game, $20, $30, $40, $50... 60, 100, 200. I'm going to stop now. I'm not going to embarrass you anymore. You're the only person who's got his hand up. So I have one client where our biggest superfan has spent $20,000 on that game. There is a possibly apocryphal story of a mobile game business whose biggest superfan is spending $50,000 a month. She's based in the Gulf States, and she has her own developer with his mobile number. And she can call him at any time of day or night to change the game, and he just changes it. Because if you're spending $50,000 a month, they will do a lot to keep you happy. Big Point was said to have had a Premiership footballer spending $1,000 a day for about a year. It's $3.6 million, I think, that he spent on a single game, if that's true. And my favourite, similarly possibly apocryphal story, comes from World of Tanks, which is kind of a Russian guy who was playing World of Tanks and kitted his stuff out and was kind of enjoying it but still getting beaten. So he hired a team of 5 full-time World of Tank bodyguards who play the game full-time for him with all the kit And when he goes into the game, they screen him so he can wander around and shoot anybody he likes. And he's maintaining a squad of him and five other people full time in one game. Now, I don't know if that's true. I don't know if that one is exactly true. But you kind of look at it and you go, there are people out there who do want to spend oodles of money in this game. There are some people in this room for whom that word pay to win is just, it will be very, very evil. In certain territories in the world, particularly the Eastern Europe and Asia territory, China in particular, if people have got money, they win. That's how the world works. So why shouldn't games work like that, which is not how Europeans and not how Americans think of that world. So I think we sometimes have to be a lot more cautious about how we design things, depending on our audience and our target market. Does anybody know what the top grossing, the game that made the most money from in-app purchases last year, the non-mobile game? It's a non-mobile game, actually. The PC game that made the most money last year. Anybody? Any ideas? It's not League of Legends, sorry. Team Fortress is in the list. Crossfire, which is a China-only, well, it's not China-only, but it's predominantly China, $971 million in revenue from in-app purchases for a core PC game last year. There are an enormous amount of money being spent in pay-to-win games. If the only people who enjoy paying to win, if basically if you spend money in pay-to-win and nobody else is enjoying it and everybody's getting their ass kicked, they're all going to leave. So what we have to do as designers is think about how do we make it so that people can spend money on things they truly value without alienating all the freeloaders who are not spending that. That's our challenge. It is about avoiding pay-to-win, but it's not about saying you cannot spend money to get advantage. It's about saying it feels fair in some form. And that's one of the things which we have to look for as designers. Anyway, I keep getting digressing myself from the pyramid. So the core loop, somebody put that word up, thank you very much. The core loop is the beating heart of your game. The retention game is what keeps people playing, and the superfan game is where the whales live. I'm going to talk a bit about the core loop first. Most of my time will be on retention. If somebody asks you what your game is about, this is probably how you will answer. It's a match three game. It's a death match, a team-based death match game. It's a downhill kart racing game. It's an endless runner. What do you do in the game? You run and you jump and then you die. That's what you're describing. The core loop is ideal for, it's, a lot of people call it gameplay. It's ideal for prototyping. It's where fun lives. And ideally, it would be short enough to pass the Starbucks test. The Starbucks test I first heard from Torsten Ryle, the chief executive of Natural Motion, which is the company which makes CSR Racing and Clumsy Ninja and My Horse, and you may have seen just sold for $527 million to Zynga last week, which was quite a result for Torsten. And what he said is that your game should have something satisfying to do in the time it takes a barista to make me a macchiato. That's the definition of the Starbucks test. But it's important to bear in mind that it is very device specific. So I don't believe that the mobile, the smartphone, and the tablet are the same device. I think the use cases are different. I think the audience is different. The peak time for gaming, for mobile and for tablets, is between 7 and 10 p.m. in the evening, sitting on your couch in the living room. The core gamers amongst you like to think that what happens is that people only play on mobile when they can't get their core gaming fix. But this isn't true. It is directly competing with core gaming and directly competing with watching the telly, possibly because you're doing both at the same time. For me, the Starbucks test is, given how long it takes me to start playing the game, do I have a good experience? My phone, which is actually over here, is typically in my pocket from deciding I want to play to playing 10 seconds, maybe. My tablet's normally in my bag, might be in the other room. From the time I decide I want to play to sitting down and playing, maybe a minute. If you want to play a game on Steam, you've got to turn your PC on, boot it up, get into Steam, get in. If you want to play a game on a console, you have to do all of that stuff and then have a mandatory update and then another mandatory update. And by the time that's all happened, if you only had a two-minute experience, you just go, well, that wasn't worth the wait. I waited 20 minutes before I could play. I only had 2 minutes. That was rubbish. So the Starbucks test isn't a fixed rule of free-to-play. It's about which device are you on. I have found myself, I have XCOM, I was a big fan of XCOM. I've got the new XCOM on my iPad. Because it's not very well optimised for iPad, it takes between 90 seconds and 2 minutes to boot up. So I generally play Pocket Trains instead, because it just comes up quickly. And that's because on a tablet, I'm really reluctant to wait that long for something to load. But when I'm sitting in front of my PC playing FTL or something else, I'm quite relaxed about it taking a long time. I'm kind of in that mode. That's what the Starbucks test is all about. It's about, do I get people into the game quickly and give them a good experience in a mode that fits the game they're playing? So don't take it as a rule that all free-to-play games have to have tiny bite-sized chunks. Somebody said they played Team Fortress and League of Legends. That doesn't pass a Starbucks test because the smallest session is a deathmatch. And yet it's incredibly successful. It's in the list of the top 10. The call loop should be free. You should be able to experience it. So I'm going to test your knowledge of free-to-play games as we run through this. I want you to shout out whenever you recognise a game. So what's this one? So it's an endless runner. The core loop is run and stay alive for as long as you can. This one? Temple Run. They're easier at the beginning. This one? Subway Surfers. So there you are. Three endless runners. The core loop is start running. When you crash into something, you die. Very easy for people to understand. This one? I think that was on your course. You're required to play it, aren't you? So in this one, you turn up, you plant a thing, you go away. You come back, you harvest a thing. That's the kind of core loop. There's pretty well always something you can collect and plant every time you turn up. This game brilliantly passes the Starbucks test, although it is a little bit slow to load. This one? Dragon Cities. Thank you. Well done. I forgot to bring my Haribo to throw at you as a reward. But Dragon City is a Facebook game. It's basically, you know, Farmville with dragons, like Dragonvale and everything else. Again, you can always turn up and there is something for you to collect or do all of the time. That one? Bejeweled. It's not quite Bejeweled. It's Bejeweled is the other one. It's Bejeweled Blitz. But yes, Bejeweled Blitz is brilliant. The core rule of Bejeweled is that you can't play it for more than a minute. I mean, you can buy an IAP to give you 5 extra seconds, but basically, you can't play for more than a minute. Does anybody know what the average play session length is for Bejeweled Blitz? The average session length. Any guesses?
30 seconds.
30 seconds? An hour. Somewhere between those two. Somewhere between 30 seconds and an hour. Anything? No, 43 minutes. It's a game you can only play for 1 minute. That's in the rule. I'm busy. I'm sitting down. I'm going, oh, I haven't got time to play a game. I will just have one go of Bejeweled Blitz. And 40 minutes later, I'm still playing. So it's passing the Starbucks test. Does anybody know the game Legend of Grimrock? Anybody know that one? We've got some core gamers in the room. It's a kind of hardcore RPG. I came downstairs from putting my kids to bed a while back, last year. I haven't got time to play Grimrock. One of the problems with Grimrock is that you have to get it's basically a puzzle game with an RPG attached, and you have to kind of get a mental map of the level in your head in order to be able to kind of figure out what you need to do next. It's in my grandiose moments, I think it's like an air traffic controller standing behind his colleague, getting a mental picture of where all the aeroplanes are in the sky before he sits down to take over. And I kind of went, oh, I haven't got time to play Grimrock. And I sat down on my bed, I took out Pocket Planes on my iPad, and I played it for 2.5 hours. It wasn't that I didn't have time, it's that I didn't have the inclination to get into that tricky, difficult, challenging... I didn't want to step into that difficult... I didn't have an easy on-ramp into that difficult game. I think what we need to do increasingly in free-to-play games is give people an easy on-ramp, but then give them the complexity and depth which can keep them playing for 2.5 hours. It's not about not having complexity and depth. That isn't the right lesson to learn. It's about having an easy on-ramp every time you play that says, there's just a little thing I can do. Oh, but now I'm here, I might as well do this, this, and this. This game? Candy Crush. But only 3 of you have played it. I can't quite believe that. Normally, at sessions like this, I have a little bit of a willy wave about who's on the highest level, but that clearly isn't going to work in this room. Candy Crush is not just a clone of Bejeweled. As we talk more through the retention game, you'll see where Candy Crush has done some amazing things in its retention game. That game? Oh. Dear me. So Team Fortress 2 is a first-person shooter. The core loop is a team-based deathmatch. And this one? League of Legends. People are getting a bit, well, hooray, he's talking about proper games. League of Legends is, similarly, you don't have a really short call loop, you have that experience when you're sitting down and going, what is the smallest thing I can do? It's a match. That's the heart of what the game is. I'm using the phrase call loop a little bit fast and loose. This is an apology to the games grammarians, who are all people with beards, Ty Kelly, Rafe Koster and Dan Cook, who talk a lot about atoms of gameplay and molecules and call loops and stuff. I'm using the phrase in a not terribly academic way. I'm just saying the smallest thing that you basically think you want to do. So it's not the smallest thing you can do, it's a deathmatch. But you could do some prep without doing the deathmatch, but nobody would. It's about the deathmatch. That's what I mean by the call loop. So it doesn't mean shooting somebody in the head. I mean, that's fun, and it is an extremely good thing from a psychological point of view. You try to shoot something, you miss, you recalibrate, you shoot, head blows off, and you go, aha, I learnt something, I feel good about that. It's a very positive response. Some people would call that the call loop, but I call it the death match for this purpose. I believe the call loop should be free. I believe that you should be trying to get your players to experience the fun that you have for free, it costing $2 to acquire a customer. Once you get them, you have to keep them. Just one point about those $2. Let's imagine you have to buy all of your customers. Most companies don't, but let's imagine that you do. You have to buy all of your customers. You have a conversion rate of $5. Sorry, 5%. It used to be that when you got a customer, they paid $1 for your game. Now, everybody's getting it for free, but some people choose to pay only 5%. To make the same revenue, those 5% of people have to spend $20 for you to get the same revenue. Of course, you hope you get a much bigger audience because you're free, but that market's getting very, very crowded and very, very competitive. So once you've got somebody, you let them play the call loop for free, preferably again and again. If you're going to use an energy mechanic, it should be done elegantly. It shouldn't be pay up or leave, because it was so expensive to get this person that if they leave without a good feeling, they're not coming back, and that was a waste of $2. It should be around, this is a good point for you to leave. You've had quite a lot of fun. I've left you a hook to come back in again, which we're going to talk about in the retention game. That's what energy should be used for if you're going to use it. I'm not a massive fan of energy, but Angry Birds Go does have an energy mechanic. Having talked about the core loop, yes?
Regarding the previous slide, can you give some examples of using it elegantly?
Well, yes, absolutely. Candy Crush breaks a whole bunch of rules. It absolutely does. That's one of the problems with rules. They're more like guidelines. But the there's different ways of using it elegantly. A whole bunch of people will never accept that a use of energy is elegant. And that draws back to research, which says that everybody says they dislike adverts in TV shows and in movies. But in a whole bunch of blind tests rating how much you enjoyed it, the ones which were interrupted were consistently reported that they enjoyed them more than the ones that weren't. So we think we don't like being interrupted, but we do. So the sort of thing which has some elements of elegance, the CSR racing 10 pip limit of how you race has a meaningful impact on which races you choose to participate in, particularly when you've only got a few pips left. Because you're starting to make an active decision. Do I do an easy-to-win race because I've only got one pip of energy left? Or do I avoid taking this difficult-to-win race? And you're using it to make a judgment. But then you finish, you've had 10 goes, and you go, right, well, I can't come back for a while. I think another example is most of the Nimblebit games, which don't have a core energy mechanic. They have wait times for stocking shops, for trains to arrive, for planes to arrive. I played a lock of pocket, put the trains on the plane over, and it was great. I set everything up just before we took off, and I went, now I've got 40 minutes while everything happens. As soon as that's done, I'll be able to come back in, and everything will be back again, and it drew me back in again. So I think they can do it elegantly. It's a tricky question. I'll have to think harder about that one. If all else fails, I would say try not to use energy. Try to have other systems which make people come back. But you do need to have a mechanism of limiting people's playtime for the simple reason that way they leave not when they are bored with the game, but when they want a little bit more, and that is much more likely to bring them back again afterwards. Does that help, or have you got other challenges?
So do you see it as a retention mechanism rather than a monetization mechanism?
I absolutely see energy as a retention mechanism, not a monetization mechanism. Then again, I see most things as a retention mechanism, not a monetization mechanism, because we're only going to get between 3 and 5% of people spending. Most of what we're trying to do is to keep people in our ecosystem, because once they're in it, then we can figure out all sorts of different things they might want to spend. I don't think our challenge is getting people to pay. I think our challenge is getting people to stay. Who in the room has kids? Put your hand up if you've got kids. So, okay, that's my normal thing, that bringing kids up and free-to-play game design are basically the same, because it's all about rewarding people for doing the things you want, with very occasionally punishing them for doing things you don't want, and that kind of balance. Watching my kids, always dangerous to take an anecdote of how your kids behave and projecting it onto a billion gamers. But the real danger is that they really understand how to use this little button in the corner that takes them back to the iPad desktop and pick a new game. My three-year-old plays quite a lot of games. I showed her the proof of the free-to-play toolbox, and she was flicking through the pages, kind of going, Heyday, Tiny Tower, Angry Birds Go, Pocket Frogs. I was going, I'm part proud dad, part deeply, deeply upset with myself, dad, for how many of the games she recognised. But if she gets bored with a game, bang, she's out, she's into another game. Barely thought about it. Kids, I think, are showing us how people of the future will play. If a game loses you, that iPad is absolutely full of other things to do. So I think of these systems as being things which have to leave a little hook, a return trigger, to pull you back into the game.
So, did I understand you correctly that you would say that, let's say, in relative terms again, they would be generating more money if they limited the number of sessions?
Not directly. I think what I'm saying is that you need players. Players are always going to leave your game. When they leave your game, you want them to leave with something in place that will pull them back into the game. So there needs to be a natural break point. It's the equivalent of, I'm sure some of you have had television boxed set marathons where you sit down with a box set and watch the whole thing. I'm not convinced that's a better experience than watching one episode a week. With all of the anticipation and thinking about what's happening and all of those elements. What I'm saying, therefore, is that, and I don't know World of Tanks as well as I should, I'm afraid, is that it's fine to have a long session, but it is sensible when there is a break point that happens in the session not to absolutely fixate on the feeling of the player being, I must have one more go, but when I come back tomorrow, this will be awesome. That's the distinction I'm making. So it's not a hard and fast rule about saying you should limit for session lengths or you shouldn't. And it really does vary by game. But you do definitely have a danger of people getting bored with your game, and I would rather give them a reason to get out of my game before they get bored, while leaving them with a hook, which might be my tanks will be repaired, my research will be done, my whatever will have been delivered, my crew will have leveled up. When I come back, I will be a bit more awesome than I was before I left. That's the sort of thing I'm trying to get at. I need to talk to you more about World of Tanks, obviously. One of the problems is that when I do play games, I tend to play them a lot, and that makes it hard for me to get really deep into as many games as I should have done, because I haven't played World of Tanks. I'm running a little bit late, so I'm going to talk a little bit now about the retention game. It's what keeps people coming back for more. It can work over days, months, weeks, or years. It's been around in AAA games for decades, but free-to-play has its own twist. So, anybody recognise this game? Shout out.
Enemy Unknown.
Yeah, Enemy Unknown. So, it's the XCOM franchise. And XCOM is one of my favourite games. It's a AAA game. It's not free-to-play. And its sort of retention sequence was you had a mission where you went out to fight the aliens with your crew. When you fought the aliens, you came back. Some of your crew might be injured. You'd carry some alien technology and some alien equipment. You'd go back to your base. You would heal your crew. You would research the alien technology and the alien equipment. You'd build some manufacturing. And then because it wasn't free-to-play, free-to-play very often uses real time. It's one of the reasons why the internet matters so much. Although there's an enormous number of free-to-play games which just use the internal clock of your phone, and you can cheat by just fast-forwarding the time on your phone. And it's amazing how the industry functions with such an obvious cheat that lots of people know and choose not to do. Choose not to do. So with XCOM, you do this mission, you come back, you set up the research, you press fast forward. And then the research is churning around, your crew are being healed, and then something pops up. Mission, do you want to go and fight the aliens? And you go, it's midnight, I've got work tomorrow. Okay, I'll do one more. And you go and do one more, and you come back with research, you come back with equipment, you come back injured. You set it all up to work and press fast forward. And then a mission pops up. You go, oh, it's 1 a.m, I've got work tomorrow. Oh, I'll have one more go. And you keep doing that that sequence of tactical and strategic until it's 6 a.m. and the sun is rising and you decide it's not actually worth going to bed. Or maybe that was just me. But XCOM managed to make a retention game which had this dual process, the sort of core loop of the mission and then the strategic longer-term plans integrated extremely well. And games like the Total War series and the Jagged Alliance series are similar examples of how that kind of works. Anybody recognise this game? It's as old as me. That's a clue.
Pong,
thank you. So the retention game in that is relatively simple. Avoid missing ball for high score. That's it. It's score. Get a high score. That one? Clue's in the bottom corner. Well, that's Pac-Man. Not only is it can I get a high score, I can display a high score. I can try and beat Bob, and then if Bob beats me, I'll come back to try to regain my place. Does anybody turn off Pac-Man at the wall before they played so that it reset the scores? Yes, me too. Good. I'm glad we're not the only hackers. I'm not the only hacker in the room. So this game might be a very UK-centric game, this one. You need to know a ZX Spectrum to recognise that. So it's Manic Miner. 20 really, really, really difficult levels. Pixel perfect jumping. You had to memorize it all. To get to the end was an amazing achievement. So to get through all 20 levels, to get to the end, that's a draw. This game? Sorry? It is The Walking Dead. You're quite right. It is an excellent game. It's not free to play. Narrative, story, what happens next? That one? It is Bubble Bobble, isn't it? It's written there. Yes, Bubble Bobble. To get to the end. That's a retention game.
No idea.
So there's actually two different things in here. There's to complete the levels, but there's also for the achievers as to go back and get the get all of the stars in that system. That one? It's the game you don't like in the room. So Candy Crush, this is one of their amazing innovations. This map is incredibly powerful. Who knew that to make a match 3 game more popular, all you had to do was say, you've moved up a level. What does that mean? Nothing at all, but I'll do it, it's cool, to move forward. So they built that level of progression. They actually did a bunch of other things. This isn't mine. I meant to take a picture of mine, not just to show off. But I don't have any friends on here in this one. It's really interesting that they're not doing it in a classical leaderboard sense, so that number 96 is 10 places below a number 106. Visually, number 96 and number 116 are in the same place. If you are a hyper-competitive person, a killer of the Bartle types, if you're here and your friend is here, you can't possibly not see that as a leaderboard. But if you're not a very competitive person, what you see is a bunch of your friends' pictures, and you go, hey, my friends are playing. They're hanging out. This is kind of cool. This is fun, and it doesn't alienate you, which is one of the reasons why I get so cross with people who say, well, it's just a Bejeweled Blitz ripoff. I go, Bejeweled Blitz is intense, it's killer-focused, it's time-pressured. It makes you feel like you're in the moment, you have to concentrate. It only appeals to about a quarter of the gaming population because of its designs. And what Candy Crush did is says, well, what about all the people who like Bejeweled but like to play at a different pace, who like to be part of something bigger than themselves, who like to play with their friends or alongside their friends, not with their friends. Oh, and by the way, we can also figure out a way to satisfy the hyper-competitive people as well. This map is very, very sophisticated in what it does. This one? You guys need to, thank you. You guys need to play more games. That's Plants vs. Zombies. Who's played Plants vs. Zombies? Who's finished Plants vs. Zombies? Who's got all the achievements in Plants vs. Zombies? Just me. I'm a bit of an achievement junkie, and I have got all the achievements in Plaster Fences. Obviously, I am just showing off about that. But for some people, not everybody, completing all of the achievements is an important part of playing a game. It's an incredibly cheap retention game if you find players who are like that. Typically, I see people who do it badly. The achievements are simply play the game and you'll get an achievement. That's kind of no fun. It's kind of how a lot of AAA studios who were forced by Microsoft and Sony to create these things went, kill a person, kill 10 people, kill 100 people, kill 1,000 people, kill one person with a machine gun, kill 10 people with a machine gun, kill 1,000 people with a machine gun. It's kind of dull. Something like Jetpack Joyride did some fantastic things like, it's an endless runner, and one of the achievements was die at between 1,000 metres and 1,100 metres. So the heart of the game is stay alive, and then they suddenly say, but there's one moment in time when you have to play the game backwards. You have to change your mental model. You have to start aiming for threats. There's another one which is don't pick up any coins. Since the heart of the game is picking up coins, when it shifts to not picking up coins, all of a sudden coins become hazards and it changes your mental model. A very, very cheap way of reusing assets, which is incredibly valuable. I think that you should think about achievements if you have them. Have some that just reward people for playing the game. That's fine. That attunes people to their existence. Have some which are really focused on playing the game skillfully. What I mean by that is some of the heyday achievements are harvest a lot of wheat in half an hour. And frankly, you have to do a lot of planning to be able to do that because, as those of you who've played it will know, your silo fills up very fast and you basically can't harvest it fast enough and get it out of the silo fast enough unless you have a boat full of wheat orders or unless you have a bunch of people asking for wheat or unless you have a friend there buying wheat from you in the shop very, very fast. You can't do it. So you actually have to concentrate quite hard to achieve that achievement. But it's still in the ordinary course of gameplay, as it were. And then a third category you have is to play the game essentially using the rules backwards. Whether or not it's die in a game where you should be trying to stay alive. Some of the things they did in Plants versus Zombies. There you go, defeat the last zombie in a level with a lawnmower. If you played Plants versus Zombies, you basically have it's a tower defence game with zombies trying to get into your house. And the last line of defence is that there's a bunch of lawnmowers right at your house. And if a zombie touches it, it runs him over. But then you no longer have the last line of defence, it's gone. So you have to carefully structure your game so you kill all of the zombies except one and then you mustn't kill him. Because if you kill him before he gets there, that would be really annoying because it's all the way through a level to make that happen. So achievements can be very, very, very cheap ways of driving a retention game. If anybody recognises this game, I will be incredibly impressed. It's never happened yet. Well... Sorry? No, it's much geekier than that. It's called Darkwind. It's made by an Irish university professor who played a game called Car Wars in the 1980s. And if you're probably all too young to remember Car Wars. It's basically an incredibly geeky spreadsheet game using cars and guns back in the days when they hadn't invented spreadsheets. And I was a big fan of that when I was a kid. And this game is about cars with guns. It's set in a post-apocalyptic world, and in this particular occasion, I was given a mission to get stuff from Elmsfield down to Texon. The game uses real time, and the way the game works is that to travel between Elmsfield and Somerset takes 8 hours, 8 real-world hours. When you set off, the game rolls behind the scenes and goes, you have an encounter with pirates. Do you want to take that encounter now? Or at some point in the next 8 hours you can choose to take it, but you won't arrive in Somerset until you've fought through that encounter. You'll be in suspended animation until you've fought that encounter. Having fought that encounter, I arrive in Somerset. I have to refuel, I have to repair, I have to rearm. That takes real time as well, and then I have to do the same thing again to get all the way down. If you're quite organised, it takes 4 days to get from Elmsfield to Texon. I picked up a mission to get there in 5 days. I had to plan my entire life around that mission. I had to basically go, right, it's 8 o'clock in the evening, I'll do the Elmsfield to Somerset run, I'll stay up till 4 a.m., then I'll do the flight. As soon as they arrive, I'll set them up to repair and go to bed. I'll get up at 8 and set them off on the next run, but then I'll have to go to work, so I won't be able to fight, but that's okay. They'll be travelling while I'm at work. When I come back from work, I can play that one, stay up again to get the repairs and set them off and do that sequence round. I thought that was geeky. I discovered at a masterclass I gave 2 weeks ago a guy who had a morale booster in place in a game he was playing. His name escapes me now, maybe Kingdom of Loathing. He set an alarm to wake him up every 45 minutes through the night because that was the way of optimising how the morale time kind of worked. Quite full on. The heart of this is how you use real-world time to influence how people mesh their lives with the game. Well, there was a chap over there who referred to them as pastime. That wasn't a pastime for me, to kind of move beyond hobby, frankly. And it was slightly all-encompassing. The super fans, the people who live at the top end of the game, don't think of themselves as gamers. They're World of Tanks players. They're League of Legends players. They're Candy Crush players. They have one game and they play it. It is their hobby. Although they might not say it, if you ask them to list out their hobbies on a CV, they might go sailing and reading and Candy Crush. They'd never do that. But that's what is actually happening in their lives. And real time is an important part of that. And this is one of the most powerful illustrations of how that works. This is from Farmville. And this is this is when you choose to plant crops. I and many other people call this an appointment mechanic. And the reason for that is that the player gets to choose when he's promising to come back, or she. And what I mean by that, this isn't like the Tamagotchi. You may remember the Tamagotchi, the virtual pets which lived in your pocket and would sound an alarm or a noise which says, "I'm hungry, feed me." And it would wake you up at 4 a.m. and you go, "Yeah, okay, I'll feed you." And it would wake you up at 3 a.m. the next day and you go, "Yeah, okay, I'll feed you." And the next day it would wake you up at 5 a.m. and you go, "No, die, I've had enough, I'm done, you're dead." Because it wasn't up to us when we promised to feed this thing. What Farmville and the other planting games did was say, no, you need players to make a promise and then they need to keep their promises, because we teach our children from a very young age how important it is to be a person of your word. You have to keep your promises. It's innate in all of us. If it wasn't, we'd all be subsistence farmers, because when we took our corn along to the blacksmith and said, "Will you please make me a plough so I can grow more corn? Here's some corn, but I'll pay you the rest when you finish making the plough," the farmer needs to trust that the blacksmith will make the plough, and the blacksmith needs to trust that the farmer will give him the other half. And if that doesn't happen, we'd all be subsistence farmers. Every culture has an importance of keeping your word. So in something like Farmville, I'm going to stereotype wildly here, the average player gets up in the Midwest of America and she looks at her watch and she logs onto Farmville and she goes, "Well, I've got to take the kids to school today and then I've got to do the groceries and the laundry, but I'll have some time available at about 4 o'clock before they come home. So what will be ready in 8 hours? And she plants some pumpkins. And her mental to-do list has gone from take the kids to school, do the groceries, do the laundry, to take the kids to school, do the groceries, do the laundry, harvest pumpkins. And it's entered her to-do list, in her own to-do list. She's not going to come back to the game because of a push notification or an email. She's going to come back to the games because her mental alarm clock at 8 o'clock is, "There's something I should be at 4 o'clock. There's something I should be doing. What is it? I remember my pumpkins will be ready." And she will choose to go back into the game. And because she made a promise, if she doesn't keep it, it's all right to punish her. The Tamagotchi, I never promised the Tamagotchi, he just demanded. But I promised the pumpkins I'd come and get them. If I didn't, and they've withered, I go, "Okay, fair enough, you got me, it's a fair cop." Some people hate withering. I don't think you should always have withering, but I think you should not have it unless you are punishing a player for not keeping their promise. That bit really matters. I can go on and on about this. Every time people do courses with me, they think that they've built an appointment mechanic and they've nearly always built a Tamagotchi. It takes a little bit of practice to get into the habit of making sure that the player has choice, a lot of agency. In this case, I've got one whole screen here of different times, and as I level up, I get more and more screens until eventually I've got 4 or 5 screens where there is pretty well no time slot I couldn't pick. Cityville has a similar structure. It has it around rent. It does it slightly more around you choose which buildings to build in order to have a different cycle of what's ready when. Because I'm short of time, I'm going to rattle on a bit. But we've got leaderboards. They're a form of retention game, though they only appeal to a subset of players. And in summary, your job is to take everything you can think of, from AAA game design, from free-to-play game design, from psychology, from fun, from wherever, that make people want to keep coming back to the game. So it might be the score, high scores, levels, narrative. I'm not a big fan of narrative in free-to-play games. I'll cover that on the next slide. To get to the end, similarly not a big fan of that, but completing something that I'm more interested in. A sense of progression, the map, using achievements, using appointment mechanics. Remember these. There's going to be an exercise about this after the break. For those of you, this is where I'm a bit mean about artists. My primary thing about artists, sorry to the artists, is don't let artists near a prototype. When you're trying to figure out whether or not the game is fun, a good artist can hide a bad design. So use coder art, use designer art. Don't let an artist near the prototype. Art really, really matters. If you let it in too early, it stops you from seeing the flaws of your game. So that's one thing that I mean about artists. The second one is this one, and this is actually more mean about producers. When AAA goes, we need more gameplay, they go, well, I tell you what, why don't we have a level? We're a shooting game. Let's have a level with driving and shooting and drop another $3 million on top of it. Whereas what a free-to-play game would go, well, how can we use the systems we've got already to create more fun? How can we add one simple extra system that adds a new sense of complexity and dynamic to the game? What AAA does is it solves its problem of not having enough to do with money, with assets, with production. What free-to-play does is solve that with design, with systems, with mechanics, and with emergent narrative rather than scripted narrative. There are some people who hate that about free-to-play. It isn't as good at the moment at this stuff. But also, that stuff is flipping expensive and typically runs out. And if you want to get people to play your game forever, if you're going to make it narratively led, then you need to have bottomless pockets because you ain't never going to make the money back right now. We'll see how that changes over time. I think it might be about how we change how we do narrative techniques more than anything else. So retention is the heart of free-to-play. It's at the heart of the funnel, and it's at the heart of the pyramid. It's really important to track that stuff. There's lots of different definitions of duration. I don't really care which one you use. Don't benchmark yourself against the competition. They'll only be shouting about the numbers which are really, really good anyway. They won't be showing you all the rubbish numbers that they'll have elsewhere. What matters is that you track something, you do something to try to make it better, and you see if it worked. It doesn't matter what the absolute number is. Frankly, there are too many statisticians arguing over what D1, D7, D30 retention actually means. As long as you know that you're making it better, that's the most important thing. But something I see a lot with my clients is they get to alpha. They go, we've got alpha, the game's ready. And what they basically mean is the core loop is brilliant. There's this polished, shiny game I could show to a slightly dim marketing person, sorry, marketing people, and go, here's our game. And they'll play it for 10 minutes and go, that game's amazing. And a game designer would say, and you'd play it for 10 minutes and then you would leave and there'd be no reason for you to keep playing forever. It might sell really well in a box product where you're selling a promise, but it wouldn't work as a free-to-play game where people will not pay unless you have strong pull through keeping them playing forever. And I've seen several games, I'm not going to name them, but I've seen several games where we got to alpha and they went, we're done, the core loop's here. And a whole bunch of executives and marketing people went, that's amazing. And I went, we haven't got our game yet. If you're declaring an alpha, we don't know what this is. I see no reason why anybody will still be playing this game in a month. One of the things I'm starting to see people do is prototype the retention game without the core loop. So if you can't quite figure out how that is, imagine FIFA is the core loop and Football Manager or Championship Manager is the retention game. Because what Football Manager and Championship Manager do is they simulate the result of the matches. They actually put an algorithm in it, but for the purposes of testing, I would be quite happy just to randomise the result. You set up your team, you press a button, it tells you what the results were you set up your team. For the first pass, to see whether or not there is something here, you randomise the results. You play Candy Crush, and you think around the map, and you're just getting the joy of getting progression around the map and overtaking your friends. And you know that you're just pressing a button, and you know it's not just random. If you are feeling that sense of joy just from randomly overtaking your friends, you're onto something in the prototype. And I'm starting to see a lot of companies separately prototyping the retention game in Flash or on the browser, HTML, whatever, but not in the core loop, which is going through art passes and where they can rapidly iterate on the economy and the retention pieces without bothering the heart of the team who are trying to get it through onto the iPad, through test flight and slubbing down the sprints. So there you go. Learn to prototype the retention game. I'm now going to talk a bit about the Superfan game. I've had to do a little bit of radical surgery to my deck because I was optimistic about how much I could cover in 2.5 hours. Also, I'm going to admit that I am significantly more expert at the retention game than the Superfan game, not least because, personally, I tend not to be a cash Superfan. I think the most I've spent on a free-to-play game is about £40. One of the occupational hazards of people who make games is that they start seeing it as a game to refuse to pay money in free-to-play games. And that's kind of fine. 95% of people are never going to spend money in a free-to-play game, and they provide an enormous amount of value. At its simplest level, that woman who bought the pink armour to kick the guy's butt in Halo, needed somebody's butt to kick in order to justify having the pink armour. So if he had never spent any money, not that in that case it was a free-to-play game, but if he had never spent any money, that would have been fine, because his job was to be the fodder for butt-kicking in pink, which persuaded her to spend $40 on pink armour. And those freeloaders, those customers who are never spending any money, provide the social context within which people will choose to spend money. So as I go into the Superfan game, and as I talk about it, I'm going to be doing it essentially in the knowledge that I am often not a Superfan, even of games which I deeply love, on a purely financial sense. I'm a Superfan in time, I'm a Superfan in evangelism, I've often spent money, but I'm not up there at the $6,000 that we've sometimes talked about. So for me, the Superfan game is when the game transitions from being a game to being a hobby. You no longer think of yourself as a gamer, you think of yourself as loving this game. It's Call of Duty, it's EVE Online, it's World of Warcraft, it's Candy Crush, and in the world of free-to-play, obviously, it's World of Tanks, it's Dota, it's Team Fortress, and so on. This is a game, or possibly the game, that you play an enormous amount. It's going to be a small proportion of your players, and they're going to have a huge time commitment to it. Typically, not exclusively, but typically, the Superfan game is social, it's competitive, and it's multiplayer. And what I mean by that is that it often has an element of synchronous timing. Lots of people have to be online at the same time. One of the innovations which something like Farmville did, which at its peak, was it Farmville or Cityville? Cityville had 100 million people playing it in the previous month. Does anybody know what that figure is for Candy Crush, what their most recent MAUs were? 255 million people played Candy Crush last month. 255 million people. That is a staggeringly big number. But it couldn't happen if they could only play at the same time as their friends. Literally the same time as their friends. And that asynchronous stuff gets the audience much bigger. But the super fans tend to be playing at the same time as other people. Not necessarily exactly the same time, but with Clash of Clans, you need to be online. You need to be there if you're participating in the top end of the game. So, is anybody familiar with the website Kongregate? It's a handful of people. I always thought Kongregate was a place where slightly rubbish flash games went to die. But they are one of the most successful free-to-play portals, having very successful web-based free-to-play games. And they talk about their top ARPU games have an average revenue per paying user of $116. That's the ARPU. Per month, not lifetime, per month. That's a very, very big number for a successful game. They have at least 10 of those. The median spend, we'll talk about that a little bit later, the median spend is lower because one person spending a lot of money, those of you who are mathematically minded will know, can rapidly push the mean up. 40% of revenue comes from the 2% of players who are spending $1,000 or more. 90% of revenue comes from people spending $100 or more, and their biggest whale is $6,700. $6,700. So I can beat that. But for me, it's the 90% comes from people spending $100 or more that's the kind of interesting point.
Per month?
Sorry? Per month. I don't think the whale stat was per month, but I think the others were. the data, if you have ever been to GDC or know somebody who has, the Kongregate decks in either the GDC vault or on Kongregate's blog are one of the best sources of data on the web, because the CEO loves data and she will share it, and she likes to give it away because she wants more developers to come to her platform. So the Kongregate blog is a great source of data. So what they say, this is from Kongregate, every high ARPU and high revenue game has a strongly social and competitive end game. What do they mean? They mean things like guilds and leagues, people banding together to fight other people who have banded together. They mean warfare between those guilds or leaderboards, so either direct head-to-head PvP or kind of America versus Russia during the Cold War, who can get to the moon first kind of stuff. Player versus player, whether it's directly synchronous or asynchronous. An important element of status and character progression. And she comes back to say, guilds and leagues, they really matter. I don't think you need to put guilds and leagues in your game. I also think you can have a game that doesn't really have these kind of massive superfans and still be very successful. So I believe, I don't know this, and either there are people in the room or you may be able to talk to people, but my suspicion is that Heyday doesn't have an enormous number of superfans, and Clash of Clans has an enormous number of superfans. And the shape of the game is very different in terms of where people pay. I think that you have a lot more people paying something and a lot more people paying a medium amount in Heyday. In Clash of Clans, I think you'll have a limited number of people spending a bucket load. I suspect it's more dependent on superfans than Heyday is. So, some examples. Rage of Bahamut, I could have used Marvel Alliance, is a collectible card game. I'm actually more familiar with the physical Magic the Gathering or vampire kind of games. But you can absolutely see how in a collectible card game, somebody who wants the most tactical choices can spend a bucket load of money as they get into their superfan experience. In League of Legends, it's all about playing your different champions. In Clash of Clans, it's defending your, it's helping your clanmates out, it's progressing up through, and before long, it becomes clear that spending $5,000, there's a Wired did an interview with somebody who was $5,000 down on Clash of Clans. It became his hobby, it became his life, it was what he was doing. And in fact, all the people who Wired found, I wouldn't quite say they were all entirely happy with how much they'd spent, but there was a surprising sense of it was worth it while I did it, even while they were spending lots of money. Mr. World of Tanks, where's the superfan game in there? Because I confess I don't know, I just know that it exists. Is it all around accelerating the speed at which you get equipment? Is it more tactical choices? I know that there are bucket loads of people in there spending lots of money. I just confess I don't know where. So it's progression in that sense. Have you played it into the superfan game?
I haven't played it, but I've read about it.
So one of my suspicions is that what people often... People end up playing for emotional reasons. There is something that matters to them. Status, self-expression, importance. And those of us who are outside it often can't fully grasp where and why the emotions are. So I'm sure you're right that they can pay for premium ammo. But my suspicion is that isn't what they're buying. They're buying status, they're buying something, they're buying a position in the leaderboard, they're buying an ability to play more often, they're buying an ability to grind faster. We see in the Far East, people who are bad at a game, particularly a team-based game, will spend lots of money because they're letting their teammates down by a lack of skill, and they should be expected to pay money because they don't have skill. So it's almost a badge of... It's not a badge of honour because it's admitting you're not very good, but whereas in the West, spending money is cheating, in the East, it's, well, you should spend money because you're not good enough not to spend money and you'd be letting your clan down if you weren't spending money. There's also a very big flirting component in the Far East. A lot of single guys paying for the gaming habit of single girls as a way of getting closer to them. Things which don't fully make sense to a lot of us in the Western context. This is a game called Stronghold Kingdoms. In Stronghold Kingdoms, It's a game I've worked on. It's basically a game where you build a castle and people attack it and try to knock it down and you attack theirs. The key thing you can buy are strategy cards. Strategy cards which are a bit like a collectible card game cards, which you can play for tactical advantage. And you buy packs of them, five with lots of different things in them. They're always valuable, but some are more valuable than others. And there are people in there who are deep in a political endgame that the ordinary players have no idea is going on. No idea is happening. But there's a limited bunch of people spending an enormous amount of time and money to control the factions and the glory race. And there's a bunch of players who are just turning up there and building a castle and, you know, tending the economic environment. And they've no idea these political ructions are going on up above their heads for lots of money. Battle Pirates is another game, which, again, I don't know it well enough. I shouldn't really put it up because I know it makes lots of money, but I don't know how. And this is one of my favourite examples of a superfan game. This is purely for time. Do you recognise what this is from, anyone? It's a screenshot of space in EVE Online. And it was the day in which this group of people took down the Band of Brothers, which was that group of people. It took 2 years in the planning. They had to infiltrate somebody into the very highest level of the executive structure of Band of Brothers. That person was a spy. When he got to the top on a particular day, he took down all of the defences across EVE Online when the whole rest of his gang, it was certainly hundreds, I think it was thousands of people, were ready. And in one day, they wiped out an entire corporation, clan, which had been 5 years in the building. And because EVE Online has real online, has real money, you can grind your way to earn titans, or you can pay Plex to get to help you towards titans. There's an exchange rate between the value of a titan and the value of the real the value in dollars. I think it's about $5,000 a titan. And a whole bunch of them were destroyed on that day. I mean, I think that corporation lost tens of thousands of real world dollars in a day. It's not free to play. This all happened with people spending an enormous amount of time and effort outside the game. The majority of the EVE superfan game takes place in forums and on ICQ and in YouTube, and then they come together in the game to execute on their plans. In that case, in EVE, because you can transfer, there is an opportunity to buy ISK for real-world cash. There is an element of that that has benefited CCP. But the superfan game is when people are starting to talk tactics and strategies outside the game, and they are committing real time or real money to these titles. That sort of thing really matters. So if you're building your own game, don't worry too much about the superfan game. If you don't get the core loop right, if you don't get the retention game right, you ain't got no customers, you ain't got no superfans, who cares? Have an eye to how you might be able to do clan-based, group-based, whether or not leaderboards are going to be at the heart of what you do when you head towards the superfan game. But don't worry too much about building it while you're trying to find out whether or not this game has legs. Remember, the superfan won't exist without the freeloaders. You're not trying to make everybody into a superfan. There's no point in me going, ha ha, look at how rich I am, if there aren't lots of people who aren't rich. People won't spend money in that way. I'm not sure we've got time to talk about it, but does anybody remember the app I Am Rich on the App Store? $1,000, picture of a diamond. That was it. Its sole purpose was to say to you, hey, I can afford this. Guess, think what else I could have afforded. That's what it was for. There are many things that might happen in that superfan game. It's your hobby. It might be about showing off. It might be about having followers. It might be about knowing stuff. It might be about being skilled. It might be about taking down the Band of Brothers. There's any number of things that might drive people. Do start understanding the emotional drivers for your superfans, and love your freeloaders as well. But remember that you don't necessarily need to build that in from the very beginning. And that bit is really important. You never know who is going to become a superfan. So you can't just, as somebody walks in the door, you haven't spent for the first week, right, out you go, you're obviously a cheapskate. That's a big mistake in the free-to-play world. So what I'm about to do is to do a very quick exercise so that I can wrap up a little bit of conceptual stuff about monetization. The pyramid is a structure where you build the core loop. That's the foundation of everything. You keep people playing for days and weeks and months, and over time you figure out what it is that the hobbyists and the super fans love, and they will start giving you opportunities to say, we want to give you money to do certain things. And your job as designers is to figure out what you can let them spend on that won't make everybody else hate you, them, and the game. The relationship between the pyramid, which is a design technique, and the funnel, which is a business technique, is very, very close. It's retention which sits in both of them, which is why retention is so important. And there's a poster. So what I'm going to do, it's going to be a super quick exercise, otherwise we're not going to be out of here at 7:30, is if you can kind of break into groups, and I suggest the way you do it is basically you turn round and you take two people and you pick two people behind you, and we aim for groups of about four, and if you're loose, figure out how to join a group. And we'll do this quickly. What I want you to do is just pick a free-to-play game that most of you know in some way. This might be harder than I had hoped in this room. But I put some ideas up there. Agree that within the first 10 seconds. Identify as many retention techniques as that game is using. Do they have a score system? Do they have an achievement system? Do they have a three-star system? Is there a map? Why not? Do they have something which does the same thing a map might do? Do they have leaderboards? Does it matter? What I'm even going to do is put that list up to make it easier. So broadly, if you four there, just kind of turn around, you're one group. You can be a group of six. There you go, you turn around. Just do that. I'll come back in just 5 minutes. I'm going to ask you to tell me what game you've done and then these ideas. So form groups. Okay, although this could take a lot longer, then you won't be home for beer by 7:30. So I think we're going to have to stop the group for a moment. I'm going to ask one or two groups to talk about their games. If you did the same game, I'd like you to tell me that you did the same game so we can involve more groups. I'm not going to pick on the people at the front because they always get picked on, I imagine. So I'm going to pick on that group of three there. So what game were you focused on, did you pick?
Well, when we were creative, we went with Clash of Clans.
You went for Clash of Clans. Anybody else do Clash of Clans? Excellent, excellent. Well, that's easy. That's lucky for you, because that means it's not just you. So what did you identify in Clash of Clans? Just give me one.
Well, let's start with levels. Everything level starts. I mean, the player has his own level, a full level on the left side. And then every building, every unit, everything has their own level.
Okay.
So you want to progress with those things.
I'm going to call that progression, not levels, just to avoid the confusion with the Angry Birds structure of levels, which is very gated content. That was progression driven by ranking, and it's the player, and it's everything, isn't it? So it's the units. Let's call it the units and the building. Okay, one of the groups back there. Did you have another one?
Well, one thing is seeing what you can attain. So in the shop, you can just browse through everything that you have, or also you can visit other people's villages.
Okay, so you've got
an idea of what's up, what you can get.
I like the idea as the shop, as a retention technique. Everything comes back to retention. It's not just all about monetization. There's a phrase which I'm using quite a lot with my clients, which is pull through. You need some reason for people to go, I've got something I'm working towards. And you can do that with ranks, but you can also do that with stuff in the shop. What was the other phrase you said? Seeing your friends. Was that the other element? Now that's a really interesting one, because that plays on the, that's a very social element. It's very hard to imagine that working in a single player game. I had one client who was selling virtual items for people to dress their avatar, and they weren't selling. And they go, I don't understand, you can sell hats in Team Fortress, but you can't sell it in our game. And I played the game, and I went to try and look at my client's avatar, and I couldn't. And I said, can you visit each other? And he said, no. I said, so hold on, this is a social game where the only person who can see my avatar is me, and I know the only person who can see the avatar is me. Why would I ever decorate it? When you're on your own, at home, and nobody is looking, do you wear your finest clothes, or do you just slob out in a dirty old jeans and a T-shirt? The same is true online, exactly the same. And so the idea of other villages, it will actually drive people to do stuff because they'll see other people's villages and go, I can do that. But they'll also go, hold on, they're going to look at mine. And when they look at mine, I don't want to have a rubbish village. I need to make it look prettier. I need to make it more effective in Clash of Clans. But in a game like Farmville, actually, it's I need a duck pond. I need more pretty trees. I need to make it look pretty. So that social pressure is definitely powerful. Who else was doing Clash of Clans? Any other suggestions?
Yeah, we had positive and negative points.
Okay. Okay, so you've got the positive, which is collection, and the negative, which is, you know, village destruction. Okay, I'll take one more because you put your hand up.
So it's a social redemption, it's the guild activity.
It's the guild activity as well. Ooh. And there is no doubt that letting your friends down is an important part of it. I quit playing MMOs basically when I moved in with the girl who's now my wife, the lady who's now my wife, because I have a rule that when a real human walks into a room where I'm playing a game, I stop playing, because real humans in the room right now matter more. But that's hard to explain to a guildmate when you're on a raid, where you just go, yeah, I know I'm the healer, but I'm busy. You know, that just doesn't work. So broadly, I had to stop. I play games that I can pause, or asynchronous games, because of that rule. And I think that is an important part of understanding that I couldn't figure out a resolution between satisfying my guild responsibilities, as it were, and satisfying my real-world responsibilities. So the only thing to do was to cut ties with one of them. Very glad I made it that way round. But I imagine there are people who made the choice the other way round in that situation. Anybody over here do a different game? A game that wasn't Clash of Clans? What was your game?
We had
Anybody do Heyday? Okay, so you've got a bunch of Heyday people. So let's do Heyday as well. You had Heyday. What were your thoughts for Heyday? That's the problem with doing two Supercell games, isn't it? Okay. In which case, can we think of anything that's different for Heyday? Because you are right, there's an enormous amount that's the same. But anything which is different for Heyday? Because it doesn't have the attacking principle, so...
Yeah, we also thought that it was mainly positive, not that negative in the emotions related to it. And one that was a little bit different was the social aspect, as well as in Clash of Clans, but the... Like, friends require your help a little bit more in purchasing the products and so on. So if a friend says, "Oh, my silo is full, you need to buy something from me."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I get that absolutely. Any other suggestions or something? And in fact, if you didn't do it, any other suggestions? Something which is a bit different for Heyday from Clash of Clans?
It doesn't have any in-game chat, so whenever you want to.
Yeah. I'm going to write ICQ to show my age. One of the most interesting social games in that sense, totally unreplicable, don't repeat this, is Minecraft. Because basically when you start playing Minecraft, it's impossible. The only way to play Minecraft is to go and ask a friend how to play it, or to look it up on a wiki somewhere. Which means across the country there are people at schools and workplaces saying, I downloaded that Minecraft, I know you think it's great, but how the bloody hell do you play it? And you started the connection with somebody going, oh, you like Minecraft too. And they said, well, you just do this and then you get redstone and it's all very exciting. And its basic strategy is being so impossible to play, you can't play without asking for help. Which I think is why it's been so successful, but is completely impossible to replicate. So don't take that as a strategy. But I think that is a meaningful part of it. Anything else for Heyday? It's a bit tricky for Heyday, because you had Clash of Clans first.
We were thinking about it as a little bit different on the progression. It so shows the case, unlocking letter 18, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. So the cave and the boat and the fishing boat and all that stuff unlocking. It's a very visual pull through. It's a very real, obvious sense. Oh, I can see that's coming. I can see that's coming. I think another thing which I would definitely identify is the time sensitive boats, because when the paddle steamer boat comes in and says you've got 12 hours to deliver this, have your friends helped you, but also you're already in the general sequence of planting crops to make bread, to make fish burgers or whatever, but the boats give you a time-sensitive element of that as well, which draw you back in.
Well, that's actually different changes depending on the game.
Yes.
And that's kind of what I've been talking with the people, men and women who play that game.
Right.
It's kind of a problem going forward, because it kind of changes, you know, it's a relaxing game at first. You feel, and some of you are in a hurry, and it's crunch.
That's a really, really interesting point. I worked with IPC Media. I worked on a portal for basically female gamers. IPC Media is the largest magazine publisher of women's weeklies in the UK, and TV magazines and interviews with soap opera stars and all that stuff. And they had a portal which just used, I mean, they weren't a game company, they were a portal company that sold ads around it, but they had Bejeweled Blitz and Zuma and a bunch of, you know, licensed games in there. And the guy who ran it left and was replaced by the former head of ad sales there, who was looking at the metrics and kind of going, people aren't playing our games. I know they're not incentivized. Let's take out all of these free games and replace them with skill-based games where they can place 10p down, and if they're lucky, they can get back 50 pence if they play it well, because that will really motivate people. And the numbers just collapsed. I mean, completely collapsed. Because that was a sales guy's mentality. Why would you play if there's no reward? And all of the research we'd done said that people came here, it's the half hour in my day that's mine. I just want some quiet time, some relaxing time. Watching my wife playing Candy Crush, she loves it. But when she gets the time levels, the Bejeweled Blitz levels, she's going, oh, this isn't the game I'm playing. This isn't relaxing. This is intense. I like it when I can play Candy Crush over days if necessary, not under time pressure. So I totally hear your point that it changes the game. I think it's a very powerful retention technique. So the question is whether or not, on balance, it goes, by the time you've got to that level, this is a game for super fans. It won't have escaped your attention that you can spend gems in order to make sure you fill your boat. And without that, you might go, why would I ever spend gems? But all of a sudden, there's a reason. So I think there's a reasonable possibility that is an intentional threshold, a bit like the Candy Crush level 35, where you go, if you're not making it past this, if you're not prepared to ask your friends, if you're not prepared to spend money, then actually maybe this game isn't for you. And I think the boat might be part of that, although much less harsh than the Candy Crush one. I'm going to stop that exercise because I think we could go on for much longer about that and discover a lot more. You will by now have grasped how focused I am. There we go. How focused I am on retention. As you are, I know that Ilka told me you're going to be doing quite a lot of analysis as to what games of some of these games and why they work. Really, I think, focus on the retention piece. The question there about do I think energy was a monetization device, not a retention device. If it doesn't motivate you for retention, it is hard to imagine why people would pay for it in some way. The two have to be connected. People are spending money not to avoid pain, because that isn't a long-term process. It's because there is a thing they really want. And they can spend time or money. If you get the retention right, the monetization follows. And whenever I work on games, maybe because I've been doing this for a long time now, I don't worry about the monetization at the beginning. They always say, think about the business model. I absolutely do that. But I'm confident that once we've got the core loop and the retention game working, we'll be able to figure out something that people will voluntarily pay for once you've got those two things working in harmony. I now have 20 minutes. That's the end of session one. That was meant to happen at 6:30. I've now got 20 minutes to do a 40-minute talk, so if you do have to put two hands up because I'm speaking too fast, do so. What I'd like to do, does anybody recognise him? Not the Cookie Monster, the other one. Tell me who he is. It's Tim Schafer. So Tim Schafer makes video games that nobody wants to play, or that's what publishers told him. They said there is no market for point-and-click adventures. He made lots of successful point-and-click adventures in the 1990s, and then we all started just wanting to shoot people in the head in Call of Duty-type games, and they said, there are no games, gamers who like your type of games. And 2 years ago now, he said, wouldn't it be great if there was a way of asking the community of gamers if they actually did want to give me money to make a game? And he announced Double Fine Adventure, which was basically a game which he said nothing about, except it's a game like I used to make, will you give me money? And he went to Kickstarter and he said, if you give me $15, when I make the game, you can have it. If you give me $30, when I make the game, you can have the game and a documentary of the game. If you give me $100, you'll get a special edition box with the game and the documentary and a t-shirt and a poster and joy for having backed the special edition box. For $1,000, I will get the artists in the team to paint a picture of you in the style of the game. And for $10,000, you can come and have lunch with me. Did anybody back the Double Fine campaign in the room? Just two of you. This is clearly the core gamer group around here. I once, at one of these sessions, had a guy who paid $10,000 to have lunch with Tim Schafer in the room. So he went to Kickstarter and said, will you give me $400,000 to make a game? Well, actually, $300,000 to make a game, $100,000 to make a documentary. He hit that target on day one, and he raised $3.3 million over the first 30 days from 87,000 backers. Those of you who've paid attention will know that he then has now said, yeah, actually, it's going to take me $8 million to make the game, and he had to release a much smaller game earlier and hope the sales of that one will fund the sales of the rest of him, which is the main reason Tim Schafer struggled to get backing from publishers, not the fact that they didn't like point-and-click adventures, or at least an important reason. So the average, those of you who are mathematically minded could have done that in your head, and it's around about $40, which is about what you'd expect to pay for a top-end PC game. But that average is very, very misleading. So me being a former banker, I did some spreadsheet work. So first of all, I looked at where the pledges came from. So there were 87,000 people, 48,000 people pledged $15, a bunch bought the documentary. It was a big spike at the $100 special edition because it was great value if you were a fan of Tim Schafer's work, and the others, small numbers. But if you look at it by where the value was, it looks completely different. That bunch of $100 people, they were a third of the money. This bunch, only 20%. These numbers up here, 200,000 there, 100,000 there, it starts adding up. What Tim Schafer did was enable people who love what he did to spend lots of money on things they really valued. And if he'd done it the old way, which was just focusing on the $15, if all of those people had only paid $15, he'd have made only 20% of the money. He'd actually have made 40%, because I imagine that everybody who went higher would have paid $15, but he'd have made 40% of the money. I kept doing spreadsheet work, so I looked at it again. Of the people who spent $1,000 or more, there should be an equal sign on there, 0.1% of the pledges, so hardly anybody, but 6% of the money. At $250, 1% of the pledges, 15% of the money. This is the biggie. $100 or more, 15% of the pledges, 52% of the money. So we're seeing again and again on Kickstarter and Indiegogo and other crowdfunding sites this pattern, that 20% of the audience make up 50% of the revenue or more. And the reason why Kickstarter and Indiegogo and similar sites are changing the world is not because they're replacing publishers. It's because they're allowing variable pricing into the relationship between artist and fan. And that's what Tim Schafer did that was kind of amazing, was showing this off. You sort of saw that same figure, that $100 figure for Kongregate, if you remember. It was 90% of the revenue came from people spending $100 or more. So even more, I don't actually know that figure for that, unfortunately, but an even more focus. So I'm going to take you on a vaguely conceptual journey for a moment, and I'm going to leave you hanging on the practicals because we're going to run out of time, I'm afraid. But when people are moving from a physical world to a digital world, from the world of AAA to free-to-play, they are trapped in what I call the tyranny of the physical. And the tyranny of the physical is that we tend to view the world through a lens that assumes that it's constrained by a normal distribution. What do I mean by that? If you were to take the height of everybody in this room and figure out what our heights were and grouped us by how many people were of that height, we'd follow a pattern roughly like that. We'd follow a similar pattern for weight. But if you did it by wealth, which is not a property constrained by physical laws, it would look nothing like that. I'm about to illustrate that. And not only that, but if Bill Gates walked in, we would all, on average, suddenly be multimillionaires, although clearly nothing's actually changed. So, does anybody know who that is? No guess? Guess who he is? Guess what he represents? He's the tallest man, thank you. Thank you for being brave. Robert Pershing Wardlow, an American, died in 1942, 8 foot 11.1 when he died at the age of 22. He was 6 foot 2 at 12, never stopped growing. And do you know who that is? Thank you, the world's shortest man. He's Nepali Chandra Dang, 1 foot 9 inches. Incredibly short. So the average height of a British man is 5 foot 9 inches. A Finnish man's taller. Not as tall as the Dutch, they're the tallest in Europe. The tallest man is 50% taller than the average, freakishly tall. The shortest man is a third of the height of the average, freakishly short. That's the world constrained by physical. If you were to say, I sold 1 million copies of my game for an average of $10, in the old world, you would assume that people paid somewhere between $5 and $15, and most people paid $10, and you'd be right. And the mean, the median, and the mode would be roughly there. And because I'm short of time, I'm not going to dig into this, so sorry for those of you who don't instantly grasp those three different averages. When you start thinking about things which are not constrained by physical constraints, you tend to see something following a power law. So let's talk about wealth, which was the example I gave a moment ago. This is a homeless person. I once said he was worth nothing and got in a lot of trouble for that. What I mean is that his capital value is zero. He doesn't have any money. And so his assets are zero. That is Lakshmi Mittal, the richest man in Britain. His assets are 12.7 billion. If you notice, Robert Wadlow, shortest man, about four times taller. Him, infinitely richer. And the median value of a British household is about £200,000. That does include the state pension and personal pension, so it's not the amount that people can lay their hands on. So in the previous example, I'm going to go back to height now. There's a thing about heights. If you are above the average for your country, you know exactly how tall you are. If you are below the average, you know roughly how tall you are. I'm about 5'8", something like that. But Robert Wadlow, 50% taller than me. Tallest man ever lived, only 50% taller than me. This guy, assuming I'm at the median, 6 million% richer than me. When we think about the averages, the modes, the largest group of people in Britain, that's going to be below the median. It will be in the few tens of thousands. The median will be 200,000. The mean, one of him, is equivalent to 600,000, 60,000 of those. What do I mean by that? If somebody tells you that I have 1 million customers and an ARPU of $10, in the old world, that meant most people spent $10. In the new world, you don't know whether or not all of those million people spent $10 or one person spent $10 million. And while that extreme is not terribly likely, the fact is that it follows that curve. And everything you should be doing as you are thinking about free-to-play games, about AAA games, about music and books and films and everything else is to go, when something goes digital, the price will trend to free because competitors will figure out how to give it away and still make money. My job is to go within that world where I have a one-to-one online connection with people. I need to be able to let them spend more than the average, much more than the average, if I want to have any chance at all of making a similar amount of revenue as I used to. Let me put it into very simple terms in terms of music. A big music fan when I was growing up would buy an album a week for about $10, spending $500 a year. A music fan today would go, why would I do that? I can get all the music I want for free. But what they will do is spend money on their favourite band, whether or not it's gigging or T-shirts or being the first to get the physical item. They will want some albums physically to say, I care about this band. They are more likely to allocate $100 to each of five bands than to allocate $10 to each of 50 bands. And our job is to give them something that they value enough to give us that $100, to give us that $1,000. And in music, we tend to focus on thinking about gigs, which is one element of it, but it's not the only one, because there are lots of things that people value. This talk is very drawn from my book, The Curve, and free-to-play isn't about free. It's not the important bit. The important bit is the variable demand. You don't even need to be free. This strategy can work with a paid game. I think doing it the way Electronic Arts is doing it with its paid games is not a good way, because it is dropping the emotional relationship between a creator and a player that a paid game creates, and overlaying it with an assumption that it's appropriate to charge them in the same way you would for a free game, when the emotional relationship is completely different. So I have no issue with variable pricing on a paid game, and I have quite a lot of issue with dropping a free-to-play model straight on top of a paid game without adapting it for the difference of the emotional connection you have with your players. So what AAA studios tend to ask is, how can I get a customer who won't spend $60 to spend $6? But what they should actually be doing is going, how do I get somebody who does want to spend $60 to spend $600? And surprisingly, against all the odds, one of the studios which is getting this most right is Activision, which I never thought I'd say. Skylanders. Skylanders is a perfect example of this, of a curve strategy in action. You get a game which people buy for $60, and if they like it, $1,000 later, their kids have stopped asking for stuff. In World of Warcraft, a subscription-based business, they are making, Warcraft made last year more money from in-app purchases than the Old Republic did. And Warcraft is a subscription business and the Old Republic is free. So I don't know, Call of Duty was subscription and now they eliminated the subscription. Something is coming that's a variable pricing strategy for Call of Duty. I don't know what, but something is coming that's a variable pricing strategy for Call of Duty. But there's a challenge here, which is, what will people pay for? And people in the content industries think people will pay for content, which is unfortunately just plain wrong. People will very soon expect to get all the content they want forever for free, and you'll need to sell them something else, including the "I paid for this" is what they're actually paying for. So to understand what people will pay for, isn't it all about sex? This is a bird called the bowerbird. It perplexed biologists for a very long time, because the male bowerbird, this blue creature here, built a bower on the ground. It's not a nest, because once he's mated, the female has to go off and build a nest for the eggs. But it looks a bit like a nest. It's on the ground. It's open to the elements, so it's no good for that. It doesn't protect from predators. It's no good for that. It's big and enormous. And it's decorated with blue stuff. And life became a lot easier for the bowerbird when we invented blue plastic clothes pegs. And biologists just going, why? Why does he do this? Why does he do it? And then the female comes along and looks at him and makes him do a dance, and then goes away and comes back and makes him do another dance, and after a while go, OK, I like your bower, I like your dance, let's have babies. And then they have babies, and then he buggers off and is a rubbish father because she has to go and build a nest. Why? And in 1975, a biologist called Amos Zahavi posited the idea of the handicap principle. And he said, if we don't understand why something is happening in nature, maybe its job is to prove that this creature has energy to squander, to waste surplus energy, which would be good for passing on to the next generation of creatures. And how does he prove that he has energy to squander? He squanders it. He wastes it. That's what he's doing. So he's building this big nest. Wasteful. He's essentially saying to the female, look, I can waste all of this energy and still feed myself and not be eaten by predators. And she says, do a dance to prove it. And he does. And then they do it again. And he's saying, look, wouldn't you rather that the next generation of chicks had my genes rather than the genes of that dweeb bowerbird over there with a tiny nest and three clothes pegs? Because mine will be better for the next generation. And if you weren't such a rubbish father, wouldn't you like my energy to bring our chicks up rather than to ignore them? This handicap principle, it's not just male-female, it goes both directions, and it's basically used again and again to explain the nightingale's song and the peacock feathers. And in humans, not only do we do this in the mating game, but over generations it's been socialised. It's become part of our how we interact with other people, not just for mate selection, though that's a core part of it, but also how we view ourselves and our position within society. And to illustrate that, there's peacock feathers, a collection of wines. Look at me, look how much money I've got that I can spend it on wine. Or knowledge about wines. Look at me, look at how much energy I must have that I can buy this house and feed myself and look after myself and still gather all of this surplus and unnecessary knowledge about wine. People who have 3 degrees are saying, look, I can do all this stuff and still feed myself and be really clever and not contribute anything to society, sorry. And I must. That's a way of demonstrating my surplus energy. Mandarins in 17th century China would have fingernails so long that they couldn't pick up cups or chopsticks or toothbrushes. And they were basically saying, I can afford to have servants to attend to my every whim. Look at how rich I must be. This is the complete works of Terry Pratchett. I have the complete works of Star Wars on my bookshelves. That is the handicap principle. I can afford to have a comprehensive universe, of a comprehensive knowledge of the expanded universe of Star Wars, and still feed myself and clothe myself and dress in smart shirts. Wouldn't you love to have me as a mate? You've never heard Star Wars as a mating strategy used ever before. The basic point is that we've now moved this way beyond mating strategy. Everything we do is social. And the reason why this matters for free-to-play games is not quite just Facebook, but it's basically Facebook. Halfway through last year, Facebook hit a milestone where 1 billion people logged on to Facebook in a single month. Those 1 billion people have an average of 150 friends. I nearly did air quotes of friends, but actually for a lot of us, there are people we talk to and connect with and have real friendships more often on Facebook than we see in the real world. I have friends who I've never met, who I only know via Twitter. I say that with hesitation because I don't think I can count them as a friend until I've met them, had a beer or a coffee or something, but they're pretty darn close. All of this stuff is about socialisation. It's about demonstrating who you are in some way in a context, in a social context. It's not just about conspicuous consumption. That's the easiest one to understand. Bling, people paying $1,000 for the I Am Rich app, that's the easiest to understand. But knowledge, or I tracked down this obscure album, or these particular clothes from a bohemian shop, or this is how I choose to dress, look at how different I am. I'm about to talk about goths and emos, I'm too old to tell the difference, but what they're saying is, look at me, how different I am, they all look the same. They're paying something for some kind of social context. I'm going to just have to leave you with the thought that says, that is what is happening with virtual goods in a free-to-play world. People are not buying gems. They're not buying currency. They're buying something social. That might be progression. Look how far I've got in Candy Crush. That might be competition. I've beaten my friend. It might be self-expression. I'm playing Team Fortress and I want an orange hat, not a pink hat. Or it might be that girl who wants to kick this guy's butt for being a misogynist in pink and she's paying for revenge. All of those are what people are actually paying for in free-to-play games. So, to be honest, it's what they were paying for in AAA as well. You sort of thought you were paying for Skyrim. But actually, what you're doing is you're paying for, sure, 100 hours of exploration, but it says something about you to yourself. I'm the kind of guy who enjoys Skyrim. I'm the kind of person who gets a lot out of it. I'm an explorer. I want to talk to my friends about it. There is a social context. But that was in a pre-Facebook, pre-connected, pre-everybody-knows-what's-going-on world. In that connected world, this has become ever more important, and I believe people are going to be giving that content away so much more that it will become impossible to sell content. The only thing you'll be able to sell is emotions. We're not there yet. We've got a while to go. But that's where we're headed. So those are things that people will pay for. They'll pay to fit in. They'll pay to stand out. They'll pay to be goths in a non-goth world. They'll pay to flirt. They'll pay to make friends. In Candy Crush, when you log back in, the first thing I get is a bunch of lives which have been given to me, heart after heart after heart. I log back in and all my friends have sent me love. It's a very, very social game. And I'm going to flick through all of this because we've run out of time. And this is my summary. The heart of good free-to-play game design is retention, not monetization. The core loop is the beating heart of it. The retention game keeps people playing for weeks and months. The superfan game is for the committed player, but the variable pricing piece says, and this is where Dungeon Keeper is failing, the people who designed Dungeon Keeper thought that energy is a monetization mechanic, not a retention mechanic. People spend because we can skin a box, manipulate them through conditioning, and that worked for a while. But in the long term, as our friendships and relationships and connections move online, then the things we would choose to spend money on in the real world, the fact that I stand up in front of you dressed in a banker shirt and cufflinks and you guys are dressed like game developers, that says something about who we are to each other. That's moving online, and that's what we're selling in the world of free-to-play. So on that sort of emotional note, where I think we should say we should love our customers, I love you all. Thank you very much for being such a interactive group. I think we should end, and thank you, Ilka, but I think we should end with a big round of applause to us, to Ilka, and indeed to me. Thank you very much.
Any questions to Nicholas?
I'm very happy to answer questions. I'm very happy to hang around. If people need to dash, I won't be offended, because I did take you right to 7:30.
What's your say on building these super fine game elements on mobile games and then on like PC games? I would assume that it's a lot easier to make a PC game that kind of elements.
It is much easier to make a free-to-play game attract super fans on a core title, I agree. Having said that, Supercell has unequivocally got $5,000 spenders on Clash of Clans, and that's a matter of public record. There's a second issue, which is that core gamers are embarrassed to admit that they've spent money on free-to-play games at all, much more embarrassed to admit they've spent them on mobile or tablet free-to-play games, and yet they continue to be, in most of the surveys, the biggest group of people who spend money on free-to-play games. They just deny it. That's going to pass. The stigma of core gamers going, well, I can't admit to paying money for free-to-play, will pass. It might take another decade, but as you get a whole bunch of 10-year-olds playing iPad games now, becoming 15-year-olds playing League of Legends and Team Fortress and everything else, they're just going to assume that there are people who spend and people who don't. And then they're going to go to college and still not have any money and not spend, and then they're going to get jobs and suddenly find they don't have any time, and all of a sudden they'll be spending like crazy and it will all be over. In a good way, that is. So I do think it is much easier on PC. I do think it is much easier. There's also a possibility that it is easier at the moment to acquire customers on PC. It is easier to mobilise a community and a tribe. Having said that, the community and tribe that is easiest to mobilise on PC is the community and tribe who hates free-to-play with a passion and wants to support indie Steam games. Although Steam, writ large, is a free-to-play game. Valve is the most psychologically manipulative games company there is. Beat Zynga into the ground. Let's do a quick quiz. Who here has bought a game on Steam? Who here has bought a game in a Steam sale? Who here has bought a game in a Steam sale and never played it? Who has more than three games they've never played? 5 they've never played, 10 they've never played, 20 they've never played. There you go, you're a super fan on Steam, just done in a slightly different way. So a variable pricing structure. So the answer to your question is yes, it is easier. I think that is just going to change. And, you know, The Hobbit, while still a core game, is mid-core, it's not casual. And it was one of the top grossing games, one of the top 5 grossing games in 2013. I struggle to call Clash of Clans a casual game. And we're just going to see more and more of these things come to tablet as the tablet pervades everybody's houses. Any other questions?
What is your opinion about that, or how many games there are really in this world? Because I can't remember people are having time to spend so much.
There's two different answers to that. Broadly, I think there is room for more games in this world rather than fewer because of this variable pricing curve. So I know several companies with 200,000 monthly active users or less making between $10 and $20 million a year, some on mobile, some on PC. Nobody's ever heard of those games because they've got 200,000 monthly active users or less, but they're committed audiences who will spend a lot of money on those titles, and so there are more of them. If you follow that strategy, you can be a niche company who can comfortably employ 10 to 30 people, and if you get lucky, you become the next Supercell. Whereas in the old model, you had to shoot to be the old Supercell, and that was your only option because you needed a million people to all pay $40. So how many people are there who can be at the top of the charts? Well, 10, and for the last year, it's been the same 10, because they've got really, really good at retention and spending money on it. And if your question was how much room is there at the top of the charts, I'd completely agree with you. It's tricky, and you have to almost wait for somebody to make a misstep in order to have a chance at that top. Some people will make a misstep. There is potential. But if you're just thinking, I want to make a game that people love, I want to be able to pay for 10 to 20 people to work in Tampa or in Helsinki or Espoo, and have not just a decent living, but a great living, making content for people who love what I do, I think there is a lot more capacity. It is getting harder because the acquisition is a problem. That's why I obsess so much about retention, because if you get retention right, if everybody who comes through the door sticks and a lot of them spend and you have a variable pricing strategy, you'll be able to afford to buy the customers who like what you do and stay there.
I'd like to ask, what's your advice to for pitching games that are still under development, if you're talking to, for example, potential publishers or bloggers or stuff like that?
Okay. The four scariest words in English. I took your advice. So I'm a big believer in the lean startup. In fact, my very last slide was that one. Nobody knows anything, which I find, including me, I find that deeply reassuring. We're going into a world where nobody knows anything. What we should be doing is figuring out how to work out what we need to know as fast as possible. So your question was, how should I pitch to publishers and bloggers? My kind of response turnaround to that is, what you need to be doing is agilely iterating on a product as fast as possible to learn what its strengths and its weaknesses are. Unfortunately, publishers and bloggers still have a habit of being filled with slightly dim marketing people who get excited by shiny. And shiny is the death of iteration. Because when you make this core loop really shiny and you want to make a small change, you can't, because it's so expensive in terms of assets. If you're going to talk to a publisher, I would say show them. No. The start of what I'm saying is try not to. Try to make the product without talking to a publisher and keep making the product. And while you're talking to the publisher, keep iterating and keep iterating and keep iterating. And every time you get further forward on that, more shiny, more fun, more retention, the chances of them liking what you do is going to go up and up. And the chance of them paying more because you're further through the process, it is less risky. And if you don't have a AAA background, even more so, because you haven't got that history. So almost think in your head of two different jobs. I have to impress slightly dim marketing people with a shiny thing, and I have to iterate on finding the fun as fast as possible. And one of the main things which I say about that when talking to development studios is they always have a long list of features they want to develop. Features are what marketing departments need to put on the back of a box to sell the promise of a game. Who cares if anybody likes it? I've got their money. But in the world of free-to-play, it's not about features, it's about objectives. Each feature exists in order to do a thing. To make the game more fun, for some value of fun. To drive conversion, to drive retention, to drive monetization. If you figure out what all of these features are for, and go, right, well, that one is really about, you know, I'm worried there isn't enough fun in this game. You should always be worried about that. This is for fun. I need to prioritize this over incorporating a shop or a conversion. But now the core game's fun. I'm lacking this, this, or this, and keep doing that. Meanwhile, keep the conversations with the publishers. I don't pitch to publishers. I get hired by people trying to iterate on free-to-play games. And nearly everything I do is trying to tell them to stop pitching. So I'm terribly sorry I'm not the right person to give you that advice, because pitching takes you back into assets rather than emergent gameplay. Sorry. Any other questions? Yes.
In your opinion, do you need to have monetization in your face from the start in a game?
Quite the opposite. Definitely not. Definitely not. I think there's no problem with going for 20 to 40 minutes without people seeing the monetization. I did some work. I sometimes do surgeries where people pay me for 2 hours just to look at their game. I was with an indie recently who's got a Formula One game, which is not pay to win, but when you start, he says, tell me your name, pick a team. There are three teams you can pick. The others you need to progress through the seasons to do. But there's an unlock button you can press, and it charges you £3 to pick a team you want. That's about the only point in the game when you can just bypass everything for money. And it's the second thing you see in the game. And it was just such a bad piece of marketing, because he was saying, he's built a game which isn't pay to win and advertises it as the worst type of EA style pay to win, which isn't what his game is like or he's like. He just didn't notice. My number one piece of advice was just take that away. Just take it out, because that isn't, I don't think it will work anyway, because people don't understand why they should spend money at that point. If you want to be cynical about it, don't ask people for money until they understand why they would want it and what it is they are getting, because they won't convert anyway. So it's not even good business sense to ask for them early, let alone good design sense. But my view is that you need to earn the right, not demand the right for money. And the people who demand the right tend to be the people who come from AAA and can't let go of the idea that we're all evil pirates not giving them any money, and so try and bring the paywalls really early. Not even paywalls, the pay asks. So I would say I'd be quite comfortable if I didn't see how I could spend money in your game for the first 40 minutes.
Do you have some examples of how do you implement variable pricing into a free-to-play game which is not a simulation or either? For example, I guess Candy Crush Land or Endless Runners?
Yes, with both. So with Candy Crush Saga, the variable pricing is around, they have two or three durables. So one of the things I bought early on was that I have five lives and they recharge over time. And I generally play for longer sessions, not regularly during the day. So I spent a crazy amount of money, like £12, €20 or something, on expanding that to eight, which has been great value for me because actually I sit there through a session, I play for eight goes before I run out of a life, not five, and that's been good value. They have a handful of durables like that, which add up to about £50. And then they have the pay 69p to unlock the next 15 levels, which if you didn't want to ask your friends, by the time you'd got to, what is it now, 540 levels, a dollar every 15 levels. Is that $30? Is that right? Something like that. So that's just to unlock that. Now you're up to £80. And then you've got the one more go. You've got the five more moves. I had a good friend, a client, who just texted me with excitement the other day, who said, I've just found the most unlikely whale. My gran, who is 78, is in at least three figures on Candy Crush Saga. I never thought I would ever see her spend money on a game. She spent hundreds of pounds on Candy Crush. So it has a variable pricing strategy. In An Endless Runner, Temple Run is very elegant. You run, you score points, and you get a multiplier. And that multiplier is based on how many achievements you have. So at first, you get one times, you get two times, you get three times for doing the easy version of the achievements. It sounds like I'm boasting all the time. I am boasting all the time. I got to about 30 achievements. And to get to the next achievement, the 31st achievement, I needed to either run 10,000 metres or buy all of the different characters in the shop. And I could buy them by grinding, or I could buy them by just dropping £10 to buy all of the characters. Some people would think, me included, that buying that achievement was just a cheat. But it turns out that the score with my 31 multiplier sat in the leaderboard as well. So what Temple Run did was it connected the shop, the grind system, the achievement system, and the leaderboard into one really tight system. And so I had a friend who was just spending money in order to improve his achievements because he was having a competition with another friend to move up the leaderboards. That would be one example. Other people would have spent money because they wanted their bonuses to be bigger just because they enjoyed the runs. And they knew that they could get there with grind, but they'd rather have spent the money. And the that same friend had an alternative way of spending money. He had a seven-year-old who would just hand the phone to him and say, get me 100,000 coins and just leave it with him. So he was going for cash or slave labour, and he picked slave labour. I'll take one more question. There was one back there, and then I think we should stop.
Yeah, you made one question already, but...
That's okay.
We've been talking about games that are for fun or entertainment, but do you think that free-to-play could work for games that are targeting like education or healthcare or such?
I've always been very sceptical about educational and healthcare businesses. And that's largely because they always seem to be motivated by people who go, if people do what we want them to do, they'll learn, as opposed to how do we make people have fun and learn as a byproduct. So it's the other way round. So I have not, I'm sure it would work, and more than that, it should work, because if you want people to learn this stuff, you've got to get them to play it, and free is the best way of doing it. My five-year-old knows where Vladivostok is. He knows where Helsinki is. He doesn't know which country it's in, but he knows where it is, because he plays a lot of Pocket Trains. And if you show him a map of the world and tell him to go and find Volgograd, which I would struggle to do, he could do it. That way, I imagine it would work. What do you sell, though, is an important question, because if the job is education, do not sell educational stuff. Give that stuff away for free and allow people to buy hats, which allows them to self-express amongst a community. I think in the longer term, free-to-play is likely to have to work for those worlds, because why would people pay for something when they can get all this other entertainment for free? But more dangerously than that, life has been made harder for those businesses by free-to-play, because it used to be that this game might not be any good, but at least it's free. And that's kind of gone away now, so it's pushed the bar up. So my broad answer is yes, but I think it's hard. We're losing lots of people now, so I think we should probably say we are a little bit late. We should let people go. I'll get to hang around for another 10 or 15 minutes if people want to ask me questions, but thank you very much.